from the latest on Caribbean cruises to kosher safaris, pilgrimages to Jewish Eastern Europe, and award-winning wines and international cuisine in sun-drenched Tel Aviv. Sit back and enjoy the trip with the travel edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Hello and welcome to our latest podcast. How are you doing, David?
Yep, I am thankfully fine. We've got a lot to be thankful about, you and me. It's been a very tough period over the last few days.
Certainly has. And for this podcast, we're going to try and take you away from all of that and take you back to nature. We're going to be going first to Tromsø in Norway.
And then we'll be finding healthy morsels in the woods of Israel. But first, here's a couple of questions relating to today's destinations.
Question number one. What is the name of the indigenous people that live in the north of the Nordic countries?
And question number two. Can you name the agricultural species tied in to the recent Shavuot holiday and other festivals in Israel? The answers at the end of the show. If you're heading for Northern Europe, how about taking a detour to one of the globe's northernmost cities and a chance to see Wales, stunning mountain scenery, and that wonder of nature, the Northern Lights? Welcome to Tromsø. Dr. Carrie Leibowitz from Stanford University is in love with Tromsø. She told us why.
I am a health psychologist. I actually just completed my PhD in psychology from Stanford University, and I study how our mindsets, so things like our thoughts, beliefs, and expectations, influence our health and well-being. And my sort of journey to study these things has taken me all over the world. And one of the places it's taken me is to Tromsø, Norway, where I've studied mindsets about winter and how that influences the health and well-being of people living in Tromsø and around Norway.
I'm led to believe Tromsø is the most northern university town in the world. Why did you pick Tromsø as your base for your research?
So Tromsø is really interesting. They're over 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and that's so far north that they experience what's known as the polar night each year. So this is the time each year where the sun actually sets on November 21st and doesn't rise again until January 21st. And as a psychologist, it was really interesting to me to think about people who are living through 2 months of extreme darkness and extreme winter each year. And as I sort of started digging into the literature and the research, I found out that actually people in Tromsø have relatively low rates of wintertime depression or seasonal affective disorder. They don't seem to be that bothered by the winter. There's not a lot of sort of other mental health problems or distress during the winter. And so I was really interested in this idea of how people are making it through these sort of long, dark, cold winters totally fine. So I'm from New Jersey originally. I grew up at the Jersey Shore, where we all assumed that summer was the best season and we hated the winter. And so as sort of my journey to understand, you know, the things that help people live a good life, that help people thrive, I was really interested in Tromsø as sort of an extreme case study of making it through a really challenging climate, mentally staying really healthy.
So if I'm traveling to Tromsø, what is there to see?
Well, Tromsø is really famous for its natural landscape. So it's a small island. It's actually about the size of Manhattan geographically. And it's surrounded on all sides by fjords and mountains. So the scenery from basically anywhere in the city is just stunning. It's also a really vibrant city in terms of its cultural scene. So there's, you know, several great art museums. There's the Polaria. It's an aquarium, but it's sort of a special aquarium that sort of features sort of the local wildlife. There's movie theaters, there's an events theater. So there's also lots to do in the town. And then sort of surrounding the town, there's lots to take advantage of the nature there. So one thing I always recommend to people is crossing over to the mainland and going up the Fjellheisen, which is the cable car. So you take the cable car to the top of this mountain, and there's just incredible views of the surrounding fjords and mountains and peaks. And no matter what time of year or what time of day, it's always beautiful to go there. If you go in the summer, you can actually hike up the mountain and then take the cable car down, which is very satisfying. On the other side of Tromsø is Kvaløya, which is Whale Island. And that is a beautiful place to explore. If you can, you can take the bus there or you can rent a car. And there's just lots of beautiful mountains and little inlets and great hiking and a few small cafes that are worth checking out. So really the emphasis is a lot on nature, being outside, being in the incredible Norwegian surroundings. And of course, if you're there in the winter, the Northern Lights is perhaps the biggest tourist draw. Tromsø is one of the best places in the world to see the Northern Lights and is really an incredible place to go for that experience.
So let's jump to the Northern Lights. How do you see it? Do you just go outside of the place where you're staying and look up to the sky? Do you need to head further north where there are fewer lights?
So it depends. If you are there and you're going specifically to see the Northern Lights, you might want to consider either a Northern Lights tour or renting a car and being prepared to drive around. So the Northern Lights are in part magical because they're unpredictable. It's sort of like trying to predict a rainbow. You can't know exactly when it's going to happen, but you can know that you'll only be able to see them if the conditions are right, meaning when it's cloudless. That is not a given in Norway, where there's lots of fun and beautiful and ever-changing weather. And so the benefits of a Northern Lights tour is that they are watching the weather satellites. And so they'll take you to where there are clear skies. They'll also take you away from the city. So anywhere where there's less light pollution, you'll be better able to see the Northern Lights. That said, if you're there for, you know, you're lucky enough to have an extended trip, you're going to stay in Tromsø for a month, you know, chances are, as long as you're not there during the summer midnight sun period where you can't see them because it's light all the time, if you're there during the winter, chances are, if you're vigilant, you'll be able to walk right out your doorstep and see them in the sky above Tromsø if you get sort of a clear night and strong aurora activity.
How's the food and nightlife in Tromsø?
Don't hate me, people of Norway. Don't tell people to go to Norway for the food. It's a very expensive place to eat. And so I often, especially when I'm telling friends to go, encourage them to cook, encourage them to lean into the local culture of eating hot dogs. There's a very famous tiny hot dog stand in the center of Tromsø. But there are some really great restaurants, that has to be said, with Scandinavian food, great, obviously, local seafood. Salmon is obviously amazing, you know, herring, pickled fishes, those kinds of things. But you are in the Arctic, and so things are expensive. Fresh produce is expensive to come by. The nightlife is great. Norwegians really know how to party. Again, you know, be prepared to shell out. Alcohol in Norway is quite expensive, but there's lots of fun bars. And for such a relatively small city of about 70,000 people, there's lots of festivals and events and concerts and bars. And so it is a really fun place to go out. I've also, you know, before I moved there, I was told that Norwegians are quite standoffish and not friendly. And that was not my experience at all. I don't know if it's just because I'm sort of an outgoing, loud American, or if it's because, you know, being far in the north, people are maybe friendlier. But I found people in Tromsø to be quite nice and quite welcoming and friendly. And so I think it's a really fun place to go. And
this is a real unfair question. When is the best time to visit Tromsø?
Such an unfair question. I mean, listen, my research is all about wintertime mindset. So if you were really forcing me to pick, I would say winter. I would definitely avoid the holidays. So Norway really shuts down around the Christian holidays. So for Christmas, not just for a few days, but for like weeks, and for Easter, and not the way it is in the US. We're like, oh, it's Christmas, but you can find some places that are open. You can go for Chinese food. Like, nothing is open there during those holidays. So I recommend avoiding the holidays unless you're trying to really be like a Norwegian and go stay in a remote cabin and just be in nature for a few days. Probably after the snow has come. So November can be a good time, where, you know, the polar night starts on November 21st, but early to mid-November can be a nice time after you've gotten the first snows of the season, hopefully. Good time of year to see the Northern Lights. Also, if you come more sort of February, March, April, still snowy, still a good opportunity to see the Northern Lights, but it's getting a little brighter, good skiing conditions often for that time of year. The whales, which are one of my favorites, they migrate right by Tromso. That's one of their last feeding grounds before they swim to the Caribbean to give birth. And so I love to see the whales. And so they're usually there. They're unpredictable, like the Northern Lights. But, you know, anywhere from usually mid-November to January. So if I was going to go, I would probably be going late November to try to catch Northern Lights and whales. But also summertime, midnight sun hiking, doing things in the middle of the night, concerts, festivals, going to the beach. So I really don't think that there's a bad time of year to go to Tromso. I tell everyone they have to go twice. You have to go in the summer period. You have to go in the winter period. It's a very, very tough question, but it depends what you're sort of trying to optimize for.
You mentioned Chinese food at Christmas. is there any sort of Jewish link to Tromso? Anything for visitors to see?
In the city, there is a small memorial to the Jews who were deported from Tromso during the Holocaust, during World War II. It's only about a dozen of them that were deported, but there is a small memorial to them right in the center of town by the harbor that's worth seeing. Other than that, listeners, if you go to Tromso and find a Jewish connection, please let me know. I was living there for 9 months. As far as I knew, I was the only Jew in Tromso. Couldn't find any others. I was able to share some rituals. I have a German friend who I met there who every year on Yom Kippur writes to me and wishes me a nice fast because we broke fast together with a group of international friends, none of whom else were celebrating or observing Yom Kippur. So, you know, it was a place where I got to share my traditions with some other people. But as far as I could tell, I couldn't find another Jew while I was there. But I felt very comfortable there, very safe, and definitely check out the World War II memorial.
Now, I'll let everybody into a little secret. We reached out to Visit Norway to find out who would be the best person to interview who could say wonderful things about something beyond the Arctic Circle. And you can understand why they immediately said Dr. Carrie Leibowitz. Thank you so much for your time and for being such a wonderful ambassador for Norway. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tromso Fact File. Tromso lies some 220 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Despite that, the average January temperature is a balmy minus 4 degrees Celsius or 25 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a 15-minute bus ride from Tromso Airport to the city. There are year-round flights from these major European cities: Helsinki, Frankfurt, Oslo, and Stockholm. There are seasonal routes from London, Brussels, Milan, Amsterdam, and Zurich. Most of Tromso's hotels are in the upper mid-range price bracket and include the Clarion Aurora, the Grand Nordic, and the Radisson Blue. The currency is the Norwegian krona. $1 will buy you 8.3 kroner. There is little in the way of vegetarian food, and kosher food is pretty non-existent. Head to Fro for veggie wraps and sandwiches. Among the recommended restaurants are Driv with its concerts and quiz nights, and Fiskekombinat Sjørsiden, serving fish and modern Norwegian cuisine.
And now it's time for the latest travel news from the Jerusalem Post podcast, Travel Edition. The Australian national carrier Qantas will only resume international flights in 2022. The airline planned to resume services from October of this year, but delays in the nation's vaccine program and spikes in COVID in India and other countries left Qantas executives no choice other than to announce the delay.
The online travel platform TripAdvisor was forced to apologise after it failed to remove an insensitive review about the Auschwitz Museum. It was the museum itself that objected to the piece, written in extreme poor taste. After TripAdvisor eventually deleted the offensive review, it said its initial screening failed to identify the review as promoting intolerance.
Revenue in the American airline industry fell by almost 50% in 2020, says TradingPlatforms.com. That's down to just $130 billion.
The last year has seen many acts of corporate social responsibility. Norwegian Cruise Lines just announced it's donating $10 million to Alaskan port cities severely impacted by the suspension of cruises during the pandemic. Some 22,000 people lost their jobs and state revenues are down by more than $3 billion. If you're looking for something original to do on your next trip in Israel, we have just the ticket. And there's food involved too. We'll let local tour guide Joanna Maisel tell you more.
From a very early age, wanted to come and live in Israel. And 1991, straight out of university, I made Aliyah. I was 22 and have literally never looked back. So that's now getting on for 30 years ago. So I've definitely spent more of my life here than there. But the English in me still remains. With a lot more chutzpah, I have to say. I lived in Jerusalem when I first made Aliyah. You know, I came to Arad, went to Jerusalem, met my husband in the pizza, the swamp of singles Jerusalem. We moved to Modi'in, three children and a dog later, 20 years later, we're still here.
What do you do in Israel? And tell us a bit about that.
I opened a business in the summer called Nature and Nosh. I don't like to call it a straight foraging business. It's a foraging light. It's getting to know nature and the plants and the trees and the flowers through their stories. It's going out into nature and understanding that you're not just seeing leaves and flowers and fruit and stalks and earth, but what you're seeing, every plant you see has a story to tell, has a history, has a culture, has a way of survival, has a way that it differentiates itself from other plants. It's part of our culture. And these plants, importantly, and most importantly, are plants that are growing in the land of Israel. They're part of the local poetry. They're part of our Bible. They're part of our culinary world, our culinary history. They're part of our Zionistic history. Every plant here has played a part somewhere along the way in our childhoods, in our far past, in our near past, and will play a part in our future. And most of what I tell you in that tour, you won't remember. But that's why the tour is a tasting tour. That's why it's Nature and Nosh, because it's the taste, the flavor, the smell. That's what you're going to take away with you.
How did you develop your passion for the land of Israel?
18 years ago, I went on a tour. And this, I think, with hindsight did I remember this. I went with a tour with one of these old Israeli guides through the hills of Modi'in to learn the history of Modi'in. And it was a 3-hour tour and it was beautiful. And I don't remember a word he said. But what I do remember is sitting under a carob tree and him giving us carob syrup to try. And that is all I remember. And then you jump forward to 2010, when I left the Modi'in municipality where I was the immigrant absorption advisor, 40, midlife, whatever, looking for something to do for the rest of my life, something that I would be really, really happy doing. And I was actually inspired by a book I was reading. It was by an author called Barbara Kingsover, an American author called Animal Vegetable Miracle. And it was about living off the land within a mile of your home. That inspired me to make a vegetable garden. And then I was playing around with what to do, and a job came up in my local town in Modi'in, where they were looking for educators to do a new composting project in the city. It was called the Brown Bin Project, because they were teaching every citizen how to separate into composting and non-composting. My kids basically called me a rubbish teacher, because I was going into school to teach kids about rubbish. And my kids had a field day with this. My mum's a rubbish teacher. Then an advert came up for a course at Ne'ot Kidumim. Ne'ot Kidumim is a biblical nature reserve, and they were looking for guides. I went on this course at Ne'ot Kidumim, and that is when my life changed. Suddenly, nature was just a different world. Everything you see becomes your friend. It becomes something familiar, it becomes something you know, something you can identify. And I started to develop my knowledge on foraging, discover the plants even deeper at the level of what you can eat and what you can't eat, what's safe to eat, medicinal advantages to foraging, what plants are good for this, what's antibacterial, what's antiviral, what tasty things you can make out of them. I would be literally spotted by my neighbors.
Just before we started recording, you said, hang on a minute, I want to write down the name of three plants. Yeah. What are the plants that you wrote down, and why did you write those names down?
I actually wanted to use them as an example of when I was telling you about plants that had character, personality, history, everything about them. One is the fennel plant. And it's one of those love it or hate it because it smells of aniseed and tastes of licorice.
Hate it.
Okay. Fennel along with Marmite. Love it, hate it, love it, hate it. Where are you on the Marmite?
Love Marmite and I love a fennel salad.
With Marmite, and we should say this is for those listening who don't know, it's a yeast extract, treacly looking thing.
In Australia called Vegemite.
Yeah, hate it on sandwiches, but it makes amazing soup stock.
Right, definitely. So ironically, when I'm talking about the fennel, it can be the same thing. The fennel is just, you know, I could stand at a fennel plant with a group for half an hour because the history and the stories and it's connected to a Druze story about a Druze man and wife who have some digestive problems and how it's solved through fennel. I'm not going to give it away. It's meant to give longevity. You're meant to be able to be fuller for longer. It's very good for appetite. So in Greece, it's called Marathon, after the town of Marathon. So just the fennel plant is one example. The other ones are carob, mallow. Each of them has stories connected to thousands of years ago. The mallow is connected to a story from the War of Independence in Israel, 1948. So there's a richness to every plant here. And it goes through to our roots. I'd like to introduce the tour saying, go back to your roots, your physical roots eating out of the ground, and our historical roots.
Does your tour just focus on plants that are growing and what's growing, or do you take people on the tour to see food as a finished product or to drink wine?
Because it's not a pure foraging tour, then I don't just want to eat off the plants are growing, because seasons change and sometimes the plants aren't growing at all, or they're not offering anything, or they are, but it's not quite ripe. So I would say that I cheat a little, but that's why I don't call it a foraging tour. And I will make samples of things, like I've pickled olives at home, and when the olive tree isn't in season, I can still offer olives for them to taste. I have pickled capers, which are only in season in May, but I have them and they last for the whole year. I have fennel candies, which will keep me going now, I've made from the summer. So I do like to offer things along the way, even if they're not in season, because I want people to taste that. I want them to leave with a taste. At the end of the tour, we have a picnic. We sit down and have a picnic where we all sit around and taste some of the things I've talked about. We cook a little, very light tasting, some of the herbs, tea made out of fresh herbs. A lot of things I don't pick on the tour also because you're not meant to pick so much here in nature. Things are endangered. So I grow a lot of things at home and then bring them on the tour.
Can people with various disabilities join you on your tour?
Yeah, I have different routes. They're mostly in the Modiin region. I have a wheelchair-friendly route. I have a stroller-friendly route. I have a lantern tour. For that, I had to find a new route because I had to find a route which had no stones on it, you know, which was people weren't going to be tripping over in the pitch black.
How can listeners get in contact with you?
They can go into my Facebook page, Nature and Nosh Israel, and you will find me, or my name, which is Joanna Maisel with two S's at gmail.com.
Joanna of Nature and Nosh Israel, thank you very much for appearing.
It's a pleasure. You have to come on my tour one day.
Nature and Nosh Fact File. El Al flies to Ben Gurion Airport from most major European cities, plus New York, Boston, Chicago, Johannesburg, Miami, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Toronto. Air Canada, British Airways, Cathay, Delta, United and Virgin all fly direct to Tel Aviv. Taxis from Ben Gurion to Modiin take around 25 minutes and cost between 150 and 180 Israeli shekels. Trains from Ben Gurion head direct to Modiin for around 10 shekels. Modiin has a large selection of kosher restaurants based predominantly in the city's malls and shopping centres. The currency is the Israeli shekel, and 100 Israeli shekels are worth 31 US dollars. There are currently no hotels in Modiin.
I'd like to say a massive thanks to Dr. Carrie and Joanna for being on the podcast this edition. Please subscribe, share the podcast with your friends, give us a positive review, and remember to give us a 5-star rating.
And now it's time for the answers to the questions we posed at the top of the pod. Question number one. What's the name of the indigenous people that live in the north of the Nordic countries? The answer? The Sami, half of whom live in Norway.
Question two. Can you name the 7 agricultural species tied to the recent Shavuot holiday and other festivals in Israel? And the answers are wheat, barley, grape, fig, pomegranate, olive, also referred to as oil in the Bible, and date, also known as honey.
Honey? Was that aimed at me?
Yes, sweetie.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely way to end the pod. Wishing everybody out there only safe time, very good news, and let us know about your happy travels.
And we'll see you on the next episode very, very soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.